TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Jeremy Corbyn had defied the pollsters, the pundits, and most of his MPs. They'd prevented the much-predicted Tory landslide and instead notched up some extraordinary gains.
He's got a bigger voter share than Tony Blair in 2005. This is the return of the Labour Party, and it's happened under a left-wing leader like Corbyn, and they need to get to grips with that.
And watch this, no hard feelings between Corbyn and Michael Foster, the Labour donor who took the party to court last year and actually stood against Corbyn yesterday. When Foster said sorry, Corbyn gave a friendly reply. Then his thank you speech.
And you know what? Politics has changed, and politics isn't going back into the box where it was before.
In 7 weeks, Labour's poll ratings grew from around 25% to 40%, probably the biggest campaign growth by any main party since polling began.
Didn't you get it wrong on Mr. Corbyn?
Oh, yes. I have been completely surprised by the way in which he has conducted his campaign. I thought it was a barnstorming performance. To be honest, I didn't think he had it in him.
Labour Party, 21,000.
After so many big names quit the front bench last year, the Labour family now seems lovey-dovey.
Well, the Labour Party is like a family, and we have occasional disagreements and arguments, but you've seen in this election campaign the Labour family coming together, because we know the difference between another 5 years of Conservative government and what a Labour government would have to offer.
The irony is that many of the people in the parliamentary Labour Party who attacked Jeremy Corbyn owe Jeremy their job. He's the one that's got them re-elected, and it's an extraordinary result, and it's a great personal triumph for Jeremy Corbyn and people.
Most of his colleagues now seem to hope he'll become Prime Minister in another election they want to be very soon while they have momentum.
This is the BBC covering the extraordinary gains of the British Labour Party led by Jeremy Corbyn and the equally extraordinary and unexpected losses of the pro-Brexit Conservative Party under Theresa May on June 8, 2017. This program is built around a 2003 TUC radio talk by Jeremy Corbyn against the then looming Bush plus Tony Blair war on Iraq. You will hear his prophetic warnings that such a war would lead to unending wars to follow, with Islamophobia and racism in its wake. Also for the intriguing parallels between Bernie Sanders and Corbyn, and with thanks to what Counterspin and Naomi Klein on Democracy Now! Had to say. Here's Janine Jackson.
Before UK elections on June 8th, corporate media on both sides of the Atlantic worked hard to convince voters that a victory or even an unresounding loss for anti-war, anti-imperialist Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn would be a disaster. UK tabloids went with headlines about Corbyn as a Marxist extremist who supported ruinous spending and nuclear surrender, while U.S. outlets murmured purported concern for less ideological labor lawmakers who were bound to be hurt by Corbyn's proto-Marxist agenda. The thing is, the actual British public grew increasingly supportive of that agenda, which included defending the healthcare system, eliminating college tuition, and raising taxes on the wealthy, even after Corbyn declined to feed into a get-tough nationalist line in the wake of two ISIS-claimed attacks in Manchester and London, instead responding with ideas anathema in corporate media debate that Western foreign policy has fueled violent extremism and made blowback attacks more likely. Corbyn's remarkable electoral showing deprived conservatives of the continued majority leadership that media spent months assuring was a certainty, But if you thought that might shake up elite media's understanding, well, there were 777 words in NPR's lead online story on the result of British elections, and none of them were Jeremy or Corbyn. The piece only noted how results complicated Conservative Theresa May's hope that the election would bring certainty to the country. Well, Corbyn's name did come up a few times in a day-after story on NPR's blog, The Two-Way. The Post quoted 60 words of reaction from Jeremy Corbyn. The Two-Way showed considerably more morning-after interest in another of Tory Theresa May's opponents. They ran a 400-word post, complete with two photos and a video, on a joke candidate named Lord Buckethead.
That was on the June 16 edition of the Media Watch Group Counterspin. Here's Naomi Klein on Democracy Now!
There is an interesting parallel in the sense that Jeremy Corbyn was elected as Labour Party leader originally by a grassroots insurgent youth-led movement called Momentum in the UK. Many, many young people who joined the Labour Party in order to support Jeremy Corbyn. And they were treated as, you know, invader. Like, instead of being excited about this wave of interest in the political party, the Labour Party establishment, the so-called New Labour Party establishment, because Labour was rebranded by Tony Blair in the late 1990s to be the New Labour Party, which is kind of like a Labour-scented party, as opposed to a party of actual working people, really using the tools of marketing, as opposed to having a party that knows what it stands for and who it stands for. So Jeremy Corbyn was elected, and there was just this campaign of sabotage. It was just the end of the world. He's unelectable. He was smeared. Then there was a coup to try to unseat him. He was sabotaged relentlessly by his MPs while he was leader, who were constantly leaking damning information, trying to make him look bad in the press, sabotaging him at every front, right? But the insurgency was ultimately successful in that this election was a tremendous upset in the UK. May did not need to call the election. She said she wouldn't call the election. The only reason she called the election because she was so convinced that she was going to get an overwhelming majority, which was supposed to give her this mandate to get the best deal possible under Brexit as they negotiated with the EU. And there's this huge upset. And in fact, she loses all these seats. She loses her majority. Jeremy Corbyn wins about 30 seats.
Let's go to Jeremy Corbyn in his own words.
What's happened is people have said they've had quite enough of austerity politics. They've had quite enough of cuts in public expenditure, underfunding our health service, underfunding our schools and our education service, and not giving our young people the chance they deserve in our society.
That was a clip from the June 13, 2017 edition of Democracy Now! Many commentators said that Jeremy Corbyn has been remarkably consistent in his political demands over 30 years. Before entering politics, Corbyn, born in May 1949, worked as a representative for various trade unions. He has been a Member of Parliament for Islington North since 1983. Like Sanders, he identifies himself as a democratic socialist. Corbyn advocates reversing austerity cuts to public services and welfare funding made in the UK since 2010. And he proposes renationalization of the privatized public utilities and railways. As long-standing anti-war activist, he supports a foreign policy of military non-intervention and unilateral nuclear disarmament. He was the national chair of the Stop the War Coalition until his election as leader of the Labour Party in September 2015. And here now is Jeremy Corbyn speaking at a Labour breakfast on the San Francisco waterfront in February 2003.
I went to northern Iraq in 1991, after the 91 Gulf War and the Kurdish uprising, and I visited the Kurdish areas. And the most poignant moment of the whole visit for me was going to the border between Iran and Iraq And we went to what was in reality a scrap metal yard. It was massive. It was like from here to as far as you could see over there. Piles and piles and piles of scrap metal. So I wandered around it, and they were spent shell casings, they were crashed helicopters, they were broken planes, they were tanks, they were armored personnel carriers, they were jeeps, they were everything. Every international company that manufactures arms and weapons of mass destruction was represented in that scrap metal yard. And you think, well, what were we all doing in our respective countries, fueling that conflict? One side funding Iran, Iraq, and so on. And 500,000 people altogether died in that particular conflict. So there's something deeply awful and brutal about what's happened in the whole region. But what's this war really about? If we just take through very quickly the history since September the 11th. September the 11th happened. Like everyone in this room, I was in a complete state of shock as to what had happened and the sheer enormity of it. What's happened since then, though, hasn't made the world a better or safer place in which to live. It has become infinitely more dangerous to live in, and our liberties are much more at stake than they ever were. And the possibility, the probability, and the likelihood of more terrorist attacks, more wars in the future, is increased by the behaviour of the British and American governments since September the 11th, quite honestly. What's also happened is that George Bush made his Axis of Evil speech, which I found truly frightening in its simplicity and the way in which he sort of tried to summarise the whole world in a few words, saying an axis of evil. I don't believe he even knew where the countries were that he mentioned, although maybe I'm doing him an injustice there, but maybe not. And then Britain lined up with him. And we then suddenly get this build-up that Iraq is a danger to the world and Iraq is behind the terrorist attacks. Well, anyone who knows anything about the politics of the Middle East or the politics of Afghanistan or the politics of what's gone on in the past 18 months would find it extremely unlikely that Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden are going to sit down for a glass of tea together and chat about the ways of the world. They are totally different kinds of regimes, totally different approach to everything, totally different demands. But we built up for this war against Iraq. We've been lied to, we've been deceived, we've been misled about the nature of the threat. The dossiers that was produced by the British and American governments are quite extraordinary. One of them, which the British government produced with all due solemnity and said this is a serious dossier about the nature of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and what a threat it is. My good friend, Dr. Glenn Rangwala, who's a lecturer at Cambridge University in England, was reading this thing through, and about halfway through he thought, looks a bit familiar here. And he read on a bit more. He looks a bit familiar here. And then he noticed that it was a PhD thesis he had read 2 years ago. And this was portrayed as some kind of serious document. And we're expected to believe this nonsense. And then the weapons inspectors go in. And the weapons inspectors were withdrawn in 1998, which was after that, there was the biggest ever bombing on Iraq, took place immediately after the withdrawal of the weapons inspectors in 1998. And then inspectors go back in, they try to find weapons, they don't find anything of any great significance. George Bush tells them to try harder, so they look a bit harder and there's still none. And so they get brought back to the White House yet again and told to try even harder. They get taken to Downing Street and told to try harder. Everybody told them to try harder. But as you said, you cannot prove a negative. You cannot prove the non-existence of something. And we're then told that, however, there is a very great threat. When people say, well, what are you going to do about Iraq? What are you going to do about Saddam Hussein? Fair question. It is not the job of the United States or Britain to go around the world deciding whose government should be in office in every state in the world. It is simply not our job. All my life I've been involved in supporting solidarity and liberation movements, and I was very much involved with the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa. A lot of South African exiles lived in my community, and with the people of Chile, many of whom also came to live in London. I know a lot of people in Chile very well. My first experience in Chile was the formation of Popular Unity in 1970. I went through the whole experience of it. At no stage ever did anyone of the Chilean opposition or the ANC in South Africa say, oh, by the way, please come and bomb all our cities, will you, so we can change our government. They never asked for that. They asked for our sympathy, our support, our finance, our solidarity, but never for our bombs. And I think this is a lesson for all of us that we have to remember. We also have to remember there's a price being paid by all of us for the policies that are being followed, particularly by George Bush, but with the connivance of Tony Blair, and that is the attack on our civil liberties. After September the 11th, new anti-terrorist legislation was rushed through the British Parliament, as indeed it was rushed through here, and we now have this really disgraceful scenario where governments can imprison people without charge, out evidence, out trial, out defence, who can be convicted on the basis of a private committee and sentenced to indefinite detention. Those are serious powers and very, very dangerous. And if we allow them to get away with using the supposed terrorist threat as a way of imprisoning political opposition, who are they going to come for next? You've been through the horrific experiences of the McCarthy era in the United States in the 1950s. That was used as a pretext to lock up all sorts of people who were deemed to be a danger to society. This anti-terrorist legislation is going to be the same. If people are committing criminal acts, there is a criminal law to deal with it and an open court system. We have to defend those liberties. Very, very important indeed. The other aspect of it that, before I move on, because I don't want to be too long, to mention, is the growth of racism within Western societies and the growth of Islamophobia that's developed ever since September the 11th. I have in my constituency people from all parts of the world. There are about 45 or 50 different languages spoken in my community, people from all parts of the world. And we have people who follow Islam, people who follow Judaism, people who follow Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism, all kinds of different religions are followed. And it is essentially a very tolerant area. But I've been alarmed at the growth of anti-Islam behavior, attacks on the mosques, attacks on individual people attending them, and the growth of racism within our society. And this is fueled by a kind of racism by some of the press. I now look forward to what's going to happen over the next few days and few weeks. The British government took this view that it would support the war in Iraq, support George Bush, and Tony Blair has increasingly clocked up an awful lot of air miles going around the world on behalf of George Bush. He's George Bush's ambassador, his spokesman, his vicar, his personal advisor. And it has been a rather, I think, rather depressing experience that many of us have suffered watching our Prime Minister do this. The British government has set aside £3.5 billion, we're talking here $5 billion plus, for a war with Iraq, and being prepared to deploy 20,000 troops for up to 3 years in the southern part of Iraq. This is at the same time that the government is having difficulty settling a firefighters' dispute that's now gone on for 6 months, difficulty over public sector pay, difficulties over teachers' pay, difficulty over funding of health, the health service and housing programs and a number of other things, all of which are under threat because of this war. And that has united an awful lot of people. They say, well, how is it? We've got £3.5 billion unlimited to go to war with Iraq, yet we haven't got the money for the basic social needs on which the Labour government, a Labour government, was elected to try to resolve.
You're listening to Prophetic Talk by British Labour MP Jeremy Corbyn, first broadcast by TUC Radio in 2003. This is on the occasion of the extraordinary and unexpected gains of the British Labour Party, now led by Corbyn, in the June 2017 election in the UK.
The politicisation of the trade union movement is very, very rapid in Britain. There's more industrial disputes going on now than there's been for a very long time. And that leadership is opposed to the war, but also opposed to a lot of the globalisation issues, which leads to the question of the finance of public services and privatisation of industries. I'll just give you one example. The London Underground is a metro system. It's a very old metro system. It's one of the first in the world, and therefore it has all those kind of infrastructure problems that go with a very old system. And the government was pledged, as indeed pretty well everybody was pledged, was to a huge improvement in investment in the system. The government said that the London Mayor, Ken Livingstone, could not undertake a public bond issue in order to refinance the underground system. Instead, it'd have to be done by a public-private partnership, which involves the handing over of the maintenance of three of the major lines to a private consortium. as in the same principle applies to the railway industry. And £500 million has already been spent on consultants' fees and insurance costs without one improvement of any sort on any line. This is the poison of the public services, where instead of running the public services directly funded, directly owned, directly controlled, democratically accountable, we hand them over to company after company after company who bleed us all dry, damage the working conditions, cut down the pension funds, and we end up, in effect, with a sort of permanent conduit of public finance into private pockets and call it public service. Well, I believe in public service, publicly owned, funded, finance controlled, and accountable. So my union, which is Unison, is very strongly against privatisation of services and the conditions that our members suffer as a result of it. And we're very proud of the principles of the National Health Service that we have in Britain, and indeed most countries throughout Europe have it. And there's something, I was saying to friends earlier, there's something very poignant about when a baby is born in a National Health Service hospital in Britain, the first thing they're given is their National Health Service number. Free healthcare for the rest of their lives. And I must say, many people in Britain find it quite extraordinary that your government is prepared to spend untold billions on a war with Iraq, weapons of mass destruction, development of national missile defence, and all that. Yet I think you have 40 million citizens with no access to any health care at all. Any support, help, support and solidarity we can give you in your campaign for free health care, we're with you. And the last point I wanted to make was the changing character of trade union activity and the political interaction at the moment. They went along to a great extent with Tony Blair's election of the leader of the party in 1993 and his development of New Labour, which was rather close to the sort of thing Bill Clinton was doing on the third way type of politics. And the election resulted in the defeat of the Tory Conservatives in 1997. And a Labour government was elected. It has put a lot of money into public services. I'd be the first to admit that. Has introduced minimum wage legislation, has introduced the Human Rights Act and the European Convention on Human Rights being taken into British law. What it has also done, though, is encouraged the philosophy of the marketplace in the running of so many public services. I mentioned transport, but it applies to others. And also sought to be kind of almost embarrassed by the trade union connection. And this has led to huge tensions within the unions. Do they stay and fight in the Labour Party for a change, or do they go outside the Labour Party and go somewhere else? Now, my philosophy is to stay in the Labour Party and fight. I've been in the Labour Party all my life. The character of the Labour Party was founded by the trade unions. That's where it came from in the first place. And I see myself as a union person for that in that sense. As a part of the group, I'm a campaign group in Parliament, we've had a series of conferences called After New Labour, because we're very forward-thinking, you see. And we've had these conferences around the country. They've been very well attended by union activists and party members to look to a change in direction, to look to opposing privatisation and defeating it, and look to continuing universal further and higher education, which at the moment is quite seriously under threat. And I think these are very important discussions. But we can't ignore the fact that the power that's forcing the pace on privatisation, on the contract culture, doesn't come from within any one country. It comes from an economic philosophy pushed by the IMF and the World Bank. It comes from the imposition of World Trade Organization standards on the poorest people in the poorest countries in the world, which then reduces labour costs, forces disinvestment or encourages disinvestment from North America and Europe into low-wage economies, and then tell all of us as trade union people the way forward is to cut your labour costs, cut your working conditions, cut your organisation in order to compete with the bargain basement economics that we're encouraging in poorer countries in the world. There has never been a time, ever, in our history, when it's more important to have a sense of international solidarity between the working class organisations in both the rich countries and the poor countries. And it could just be maybe I'm being over-optimistic here, but maybe not. It could just be that this war, so blatant, so cruel, so horrible, and so destructive of people that have already suffered so grievously, could just be the cement that brings everyone together, brings us together to recognise that not only are we against this war, not only are we against the grab of resources which this war recognises, but we also recognise an empathy, a bond, a common sympathy between the people in Colombia, in Venezuela, in Brazil, or anywhere else who are campaigning for peace, but also campaigning for social justice, and their right to decide their social systems, their right to increase their tax if they want to spend it on the health service, their right to develop public sector housing. And I've never forgotten a long conversation I had with the Mauritian Minister of Education earlier this year. I knew him when he was a student in London. I was visiting Mauritius, and I went to meet him and had a chat, and he said, look, we as third world politicians going to elections, we cannot say or do anything other than we're going to follow the IMF diktat, and we will attempt to negotiate an agreement with the IMF to allow us to spend some of our resources on housing or health or education. Well, these are very, very dangerous times when there's a kind of economic dictatorship that comes from this sort of horrible free market corporate thinking. It's not free market, it's corporate control thinking that's really going on. And that's why this sense of internationalism is so important. I got a feeling we're going to see an awful lot more of each other over the next few months and years. And let's make sure we all stay together for peace, for justice, for social unity across the world, because this war is not going to solve any problems. This war is not going to bring about any peace in the region. This war is going to bring another conflict and another conflict and another conflict and another conflict after that. I do believe this is a Rubicon. We cross that Rubicon into a war in Iraq. How many more wars in that region are we all going to be involved in? How many Iraqi kids, our kids and others, are going to die for the interests of big business and oil? I don't want that to happen. It's in our hands to stop it. Thanks very much.
That was Jeremy Corbyn, British Member of Parliament and an outspoken critic of Tony Blair. And that talk was first broadcast in 2003 and rebroadcast now, not only for its prophetic nature and at a time when the same mistakes of intervention are being repeated, but also on the occasion of the extraordinary and unexpected gains of the British Labour Party, now led by Corbyn, in the June 2017 election in the UK. Every now and then, throughout 2017, I'm rebroadcasting from the TUC Radio Archives, celebrating 25 years of free programming. Thank you for keeping us on the air for a quarter century. This talk by Jeremy Corbyn was recorded by Jeffrey Blankfort. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.